Jamie Lee Grace. Welcome to the Natural Health and Sobriety Show on UK Health Radio. Hi, and welcome to the Natural Health and Sobriety Show. I'm Jamie Lee Grace, and I thought I'd share with you just a little bit of info and a few stats and stuff around alcohol today. It's not something I do often on the show because, you know, I like to feature all aspects of holistic living. But I think probably a lot of listeners to this show know my own story, which is that I've been fascinated by holistic living for many, many years. I wrote my first book 16 years ago, Imperfectly Natural Woman, which was a really big success. And I've, you know, I was a little bit ahead of my time. And I've since had, you know, a whole career really promoting natural health and really focusing on health and well-being. But for many of those years, up until the last five, I was stepping around this huge great elephant in the room, which was alcohol. I somehow thought that, you know, despite considering myself to be a queen of holistic health and well-being, it was okay to drink pretty much every night. And of course, that's not nothing unusual about that. It's what most people do, right? Certainly in our culture, it's seen as the norm. Alcohol is the social glue that sticks everything together. You know, there really is an issue in this country with the way we view alcohol. It's seen as the done thing. It's the rite of passage, isn't it? Once we hit a certain age, go down the pub or start drinking at home. And then, you know, we get surprised when it ramps up. And I think, you know, one of the interesting things for me was that when I was drinking, one part of me knew just how bad it was for me. Of course I did. But there was a huge amount of cognitive dissonance, largely because the medical profession and the culture we live in really supports us drinking. Now, obviously the marketing companies, the alcohol companies want us to drink. That's obvious. But it would appear that, you know, so does our health profession to a large extent. And I don't know whether this is by accident or design, but I've been very interested to really have a good look at different reports and studies over the last few years. I've now been sober just over 5 years, and you probably will have heard me say many times, it is literally the best thing I ever did for my health and my well-being. I've written a book called Happy, Healthy, Sober, Ditch the Booze and Take Control of Your Life. And I run a podcast called Alcohol Free Life, where I interview amazing guests and inspirational people. And of course, I run the Sober Club, which is a community, a platform dedicated to changing the conversation around alcohol. So I thought it might be interesting just to have a little look at some current studies that have come out fairly recently. We know that what we often see in the press are studies that tell us that a glass of red wine is good for the heart, or, you know, that, you know, alcohol in small quantities in moderation can be beneficial. I used to love those kind of studies because that's really what kept me stuck. I used to think, okay, I've just read somewhere that alcohol is good for my heart. Now, of course, if I'd read the small print, it probably would have said, you know, in moderation, a tiny glass of red wine or whatever. But I took that as license to go and have, you know, copious amounts of alcohol. And what also kept me stuck was, you know, if I ever rocked up to a GP and was brave enough to share that I thought I might be drinking too much while I was, you know, discussing something else, their response was in every case, well, you seem fine. You're obviously not at rock bottom. So, you know, just have the odd alcohol-free day. And that's what kept me stuck. What I would have loved to have heard them say is, wow, well done you for being aware, for noticing. And, you know, let me point you to some information, to a community such as the Sober Club, where you can get some inspiration and you can get to see that life is actually better without alcohol. So just to share with you a couple of studies that have come out recently. One was a very interesting podcast interview that I did with Dr. Anya Topiwala, who is a lead researcher on a study around alcohol and aging, which absolutely showed conclusively that there is zero amount of alcohol that is safe. There is no safe level. But contrast that with articles that, you know, that do try to say that, when you're over drinking, it's a terrible thing. But if you stick to government guidelines, it's fine. I did read an article that came out, I think it was the middle of last year, which basically said, looked at the impact of the pandemic related changes in alcohol consumption, and said that lighter drinkers decreased their consumption on average during the pandemic, but heavy drinkers increased their alcohol intake. Found that quite interesting. And they basically said that the changes in alcohol consumption did lead to thousands of additional cases of alcohol-related disease and premature deaths and hospital admissions, which, of course, cost the NHS billions of pounds. And they did a couple of studies looking at the shifts in drinking. The University of Sheffield commissioned reports looking at these studies and really doing some kind of modelling on this and looking at the fact that it looked as though alcohol-related hospitalisations and deaths would be likely to increase over a longer period of time. And one of the senior research fellows said, even in our best case scenario where drinking behaviour returns to pre-pandemic levels, we estimate an additional 42,677 alcohol attributable hospital admissions and 1,830 deaths over 20 years. That was a quote from Colin Angus, a senior research fellow. So, you know, this is a thing, isn't it? This is just really not okay, to say the least. It really is not okay. You know, I think that one of the interesting pieces here is that, well, you've heard me say this phrase before, alcohol is the only drug we have to justify not taking. It's because it is so common, because it is so much seen as the norm. Those people who don't drink, who choose not to drink, are often classed as pariahs, are often sober shamed. And yet, actually, when we look at it, alcohol is the number one most harmful drug if you were to take into consideration harm to the economy and harm to people in terms of illness, the NHS, harm to individuals, crime, families. It goes on and on and on. So it's time, isn't it? It really is time to change the conversation around alcohol in the UK. So I wanted to invite onto the programme Dr. Suhail Hussain, who's a personal physician, home visiting doctor. He's a private GP who covers the Hertfordshire and Greater London areas, who provides personalised healthcare and bespoke medical services to discerning clients. And Dr. Suhail was also quoted on one of the press releases, one of the articles that I saw that was talking about just how under pressure the NHS is now after the pandemic. You know, we're looking at the fact that, you know, we know it was already under pressure and now the situation has got even worse. So I thought it'd be interesting. I don't often interview conventional, as it were, GPs. So I thought it'd be really interesting to get Dr. Suhail's take on all of this.
Well, at last I get to speak to a doctor, which is great news. I'm just so excited about getting the lowdown on what's going on, you know, when it comes to alcohol. And Dr. Suhail Hussain is a personal physician and home visiting doctor, a private GP covering the Hertfordshire and Greater London area, who provides personalised healthcare and bespoke medical services to discerning clients. Dr. Suhail, thank you so much for joining us on the podcast. I really appreciate it.
Thank you so much. I appreciate you asking me to come on.
And I know the internet connection is a little bit dodgy, so we'll do the best we can. can you just share with us, Dr. Suhail, what's going on in the UK when it comes to alcohol? Because I saw a press release that said the ONS data had shown that there was a rise in deaths from alcohol-specific causes that are registered in the UK. Just for anyone who's not aware of what the sort of current picture is, can you just give us a little bit of an overview?
Sure. So I think we'll break this down to pre and post pandemic. That will probably give us a bit more context. Even before the whole coronavirus go happened, I was seeing more people consume more alcohol in a more unhealthy way for quite some few years. So certainly over the last 5 years or so, I've been seeing people who've been presenting with end stage related to alcohol. So for example, chronic hepatitis, liver failure, cirrhosis, all these things are associated with excess that more often and in a younger age of patients. So for example, normally I expect to see this in their 70s. Mm. Now we're seeing them in their 40s and their 50s, which means they're either consuming alcohol at a younger age or alcohol more often. So we are seeing adverse health consequences of people consuming alcohol. And certainly that's a trend I've seen for 4 or 5 years now. Definitely.
Yeah. Yeah. It's really worrying, isn't it? So let's just sort of take it back a little bit then. What is available for people within the NHS when it comes to seeking treatment? I mean, we'll talk in a moment about, you know, the people I tend to kind of work with who are grey area drinkers and their early days. And thank God they haven't got to rock bottom. But when people do recognise they need some support, what is actually available within the NHS?
So I would say, and it's tricky at the moment, but your first port of call should be your GP, your general practitioner, who hopefully knows you, knows your history, knows all about you. Hopefully you're able to form a relationship with them. Now, there's issues with that, which we won't go into. That's a totally different topic. But you should see your GP, your primary care provider, and approach them and say, look, I'm having this problem with drinking, recognized, or my family or friends have mentioned that I'm drinking too much, or I'm not able to concentrate at work, or I'm not functioning as well as I'm able to. Are there any avenues for me to have help? And your GP can then sit down with you, have a conversation, go through a drinking history, and then discuss ways that you can try and decrease that. So then if there are more complications, they may refer you, for example, or they may do some liver function tests or blood tests to check your liver function. You may have an ultrasound scan of your liver. You may be referred to a gastroenterologist. So that's dealing with the liver-related problems and the physical problems. In terms of dealing with the alcohol consumption, there are two. For example, psychiatrists often deal with drug and addiction problems. So alcohol falls into that category, drug and addiction. When it's used in an unhealthy fashion, it becomes an addiction. So I might refer someone to a psychiatrist to have help with that. They may go through physical therapies with the patient. They may go through counselling therapies. And then subsequently, they can be referred to a counsellor as well. So a psychiatrist and or a psychologist / counsellor may be able to help with you with your mental health issues or addiction problems related to alcohol.
And how successful, in inverted commas, is this? Because, you know, I mean, one would imagine that. I mean, I certainly am aware of a bunch of people that I've worked with who have been and asked for help. But for one reason or another, it kind of just hasn't worked out. The sessions that they've been offered, or when they're working and they're trying to hold down a job, or, you know, I mean, nothing's perfect. We know that. But how, in inverted commas, successful is this treatment that's offered? I mean, if it were that successful, we wouldn't have this increase in deaths, right? But then again, might you say, well, it's because people don't come forward?
Well, a stigma, definitely a stigma attached to this, and people are reluctant to come forward because they may feel that they'll be judged, they'll be looked at in a negative way. And that's the first thing I would say, that the doctor hopefully will never treat you like that, never look at you in a disparaging fashion, never look down on you, never think, oh, well, look at the way let yourself become. You've become a mess. So hopefully the doctor will never treat you in that fashion. Mm. And if the patient has that fear, they'll be reluctant to come forward. So A, yes, there's a reluctance to come forward. B, it does require recurrent and repeat intervention. So going as a one-off is never going to be enough, because with these problems, whether it's smoking, alcohol, drug use, it is something that requires consistent input. Mm. So for example, there may be other avenues that you can also access. So there's the one that we all probably all know about, Alcoholics Anonymous. There are other societies or charities. Al-Anon is one. The 12-step program, which actually I had never heard of until I started watching Russell Brand videos, and what he talked about is this 12-step program. Now, this is a faith-based or a spirituality-based program, which is not appropriate for everyone, and some people may feel uncomfortable with that. But from what my understanding of this program is that you resign, when I say resign yourself, it's perhaps not the right word, but you resign yourself to God and then accept that you need help. And it's a supportive environment, non-judgmental environment, in which there are 12, I don't know the 12 steps, but there are 12 steps you go through.
Yeah.
And the whole point is that it's a community that you can access as and when you require. And the people in that are ex-addicts, ex-alcoholics. So they have been through this. They are familiar with the process that people go through, the shame, the guilt, the recovery, and then the ongoing abstinence. So from what I've seen of Russell Brand, he talks about a daily, you are the abstinent one day at a time. You never say, okay, I'm going to try and be abstinent for the rest of my life. It's one day at a time.
Yeah.
I think those things would help people look at it in small, and it's like with anything, whether you want to lose weight or get fit, you can't say, well, I'm going to run a marathon tomorrow. You have to take small steps to start.
Yeah, absolutely.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good. UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
I mean, I think most people listening to this will be very aware of AA. Some may have tried it. Many will have found it's not for them.
Yeah.
My personal opinion with the work that I do is that actually there are a huge number of people who fall into the category of what we now, the term we now know is grey area drinkers. It's probably not a term most GPs are familiar with, but basically it's people who are drinking more than they want to, but they absolutely do not fit the remit that most of us would consider you know, being an alcoholic in inverted commas, which is a word I hate, yes, and going to AA. And it's not really just so much about the in inverted commas religious aspect or the faith aspect. It's what really underpins that, which is this kind of concept that this is a disease, and that if you've been sober for 35 years, apparently you're still an alcoholic. I absolutely don't buy that any more than I think if someone stops smoking, they're still a smokeaholic 35 years later.
Yes,
I really believe you can absolutely be free from this, the majority of people. So, you know, so that would lead me to the next sort of question, really, which is how well equipped, if at all, do you think the NHS are of awareness of this huge number of people that are drinking more than they want to, but they absolutely don't need rehabilitation or to try and claim they have some kind of disease. They're just stressed, they're just anxious, they're just mums who've got too much on their plate, or people who are working too hard, or someone who's suffering from grief or whatever it is, and you know, a glass of wine or three every night seems to do the trick, and they get caught in that alcohol trap. Where, in your honest opinion, without putting down your profession, obviously, where do you think the NHS sits with awareness of that?
I mean, I think, well, I am now probably not, well, I haven't been for the last couple of years working in the NHS on a regular basis. So,
sure, no, fair enough. Yeah.
I don't want to be disparaging of my NHS colleagues, because they are very, very hardworking. Very
absolutely,
open,
yeah.
Especially, we can maybe touch on this, that doctors themselves are prone to alcohol problems.
Which doesn't help, does it?
No, exactly. So I'll be honest, the NHS is not well set up to deal with these things. The resources are not there. The professionals are not there. The big thing that I mentioned before, continuity is not there. Even you can't see the same GP two times in a row. So continuity is key. So the NHS is not set up to deal with these things, I'm afraid to say. But we also need to recognize a couple of things. One, that alcoholism or whatever, unhealthy consumption of alcohol,
yeah,
doesn't impact you in your daily functioning, is, I think if we look at it like hypertension, like it's a disease, it's a condition. And if we accept that and say, okay, you've got condition X, we've got means to help you overcome that. Mm. And if we, both the health professional and the individual, are able to accept that, then they can say, okay, I have a problem, I need to make some intervention. So there are lots of people who drink who are not alcoholic by any means. They have very high functioning jobs, in fact, and perhaps that's part of the problem. Their job is, let's say, in finance or in industries where they are entertaining a lot, They go out, they may have a glass of wine with their lunch, they may have a couple of glasses of wine at dinner time, they may have a half a bottle at home with relaxing with their family. So you can easily build up more than the 14 units maximum in a week very, very quickly, and then still be perfectly fine and functioning perfectly well. And then suddenly find you have a routine blood test, your liver function test is off the scale. You think, well, how did that happen? Mm. So A, we have to acknowledge it's a disease, I think. B, we have to also accept that there are people who function very well with consuming unhealthy amounts of alcohol, and they perhaps don't perceive a problem with that. And it's, again, coming to the non-judgmental approach that the doctor should take and say, well, have you thought about perhaps why you are putting on weight? Because another issue is alcohol has a lot of empty calories.
Yeah.
So it could be a risk for overweight, obesity, diabetes, heart disease. So perhaps the liver is fine, but they've developed, they're overweight now and they're developing diabetes. Well, maybe looking at the alcohol and the sugar that's in that could be a real key to helping them come to grips with that and say, okay, well, you know what, I think I should cut down and I should try and limit the amount of alcohol that I'm consuming.
Mm. Yeah, I mean, you know, to a certain extent, you know, I agree with you, and you're absolutely right. There are, you know, so many people who are fully functioning as I was, and lots of people can go for many, many years, and that isn't a problem, as you say. It's when you do start to recognise for yourself that there is a problem. I think that's when that's where my interest lies. Is where does the NHS and or any medical services really? What's their awareness of how they can support people once they recognize there's an issue? So, you know, I'll sometimes say to people, well, ask yourself, could my life be better physically and emotionally without the booze? And the person you've mentioned who's having a perfectly fine life, thank you, and is completely fine, would probably say, no, I'm absolutely good. I'm fine, until they hit some kind of health issue. But there are many, many, many people who are seemingly completely fine, but they're waking up at 3 a.m. and a little voice is saying, this is not okay. This really is not okay. You know, it's a Tuesday night and you've just had another bottle. It's not okay. And it's those people, of which I was absolutely one, who when they rock up to a GP, which I did several times, about something else, completely about something else. It might have been a vitamin D test. It might have been something completely different. But if they trust the GP enough to say, actually, do you know what? There's something else. Can I just mention to you something else, which I'm a bit worried about? The response in my personal experience when someone shares they're a bit worried about their drinking is usually, well, it seems fine. You know, you seem okay with what you've told me. Just have the odd day alcohol free. And that's the bit that keeps those people completely stuck for another 5-10 years.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good. The station that makes you feel good.
A, like I said, I keep coming back to this, is the non-judgmental issue. And also, which I've found now I'm able to do, I'm not in the NHS, is the time I can offer my patients. I can give them the time to sit there and say, you know, I've got more than one issue, doctor, and I'd like to spend more than 10 minutes. And so,
that makes a huge difference, doesn't it?
Exactly. I'm not constrained by the clock. I'm not constrained by only discussing one issue at a time. So I have that ability to talk to the patient. And if you can find that hook, there is, I'm pretty certain in 99.9% of times, there's a hook that you can find if you listen carefully enough. Listening is absolutely key for medicine and for general practitioners particularly. If you listen and the patient says, well, every night or every Tuesday night I'm waking up at 3 a.m. and having a bottle, you say, hold on, tell me a bit more about that. You don't put any words in their mouth. Ask them to tell you. And say, okay, how does that make you feel? What would you like to try and do about that? Or you say, when I come home and my kids want to play with me, I'm a little bit worse for wear. I'm not really able to play with them and it really affects me. And I'd love to be able to play with them. Or I'd love to be able to go out for a drive, but I feel a bit, I'm not able to drive because I can't concentrate, whatever. So there is always a hook. I'm pretty certain there's always a hook that if the doctor listens carefully enough, they can get that and say, okay, now you've told me this, let's think how we can get on top of this. So there is a technique that we use in medicine called motivational interviewing, which is a really powerful tool. And when the doctor uses that correctly, they can then get the patient to to outline what their issue is and what they would like to do about it. So we've kind of put the ball back in the patient's court and said, okay, what would you like to do with it? And then we can say, oh, well, we can help you by doing A, B, and C.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Well, I get that completely. So to a certain extent, it's a time constraint, as with so many issues within the NHS, I suppose. That absolutely makes sense. So just back on the issue you were talking about with the confidentiality sort of piece, something else that's come up recently with someone I've been working with in my sort of community is they were off work. I can't remember the exact scenario, but it was something like they were signed off work for anxiety, stress related problems, and wanted to sort out their drinking as well. So, you know, went to a GP and, you know, asked for support in that arena. But they were basically told that their workplace would have to be informed.
Mm.
So what is the kind of, what are the ethics and the guidelines around this? Because, you know, it's bad enough actually having to sort of front up and admit you've got an issue and be willing to deal with it. But does your employer really need to know as well?
So this is a really grey area. So some things that we have to tell the employer. So, for example, if you'd had a heart attack, I think you can't so really say, well, Mr. Smith has had a heart attack. Well, we won't tell your employer. We can't really do that. But there are ways we can overcome these type of things. And we could write stress-related issue, anxiety, without being untrue, without lying, because mm-hmm. stress and anxiety are probably linked to use of alcohol and, you know, misuse of alcohol. So there's certainly things that we can phrase it in a way that if the person in front of us says, well, you know, if you put this on my medical certificate, then I'm going to lose my job. And the last thing they need is to lose their job on top of everything else. So I think we have to be open enough to put something on the medical certificate that is not untrue, but also is hopefully helping the patient. And then when they are maybe in a place of recovering, then perhaps in their own time, they can, if they wish to discuss that with their workplace, they can approach that themselves.
Mm, yeah.
So I've often put, someone has said to me, don't put depression on my medical certificate. I said, okay, what would you like me to write? They said, work-related stress. I said, okay, fine. Your work is making you depressed. I've put work-related stress.
Yeah.
So there are ways that we can phrase things. Some things we cannot hide. For example, if there's a notifiable disease or
yes.
there's a significant risk of harm to the patient or to others, they're suicidal, or they say, well, I'm going to go and kill my boss. Obviously, you can't hide that from someone.
Yeah, yeah, of
and
course.
You have to divulge that to the appropriate authorities. But there are ways and means we can overcome this, I think.
Yeah, that makes sense. Yeah. And just one last thing. You know, you mentioned when we were talking about just the rise in alcohol-related deaths and illness. And obviously, we all know the pandemic didn't help that one little bit. Just as a word of encouragement for people, tell us, you know, that some of the good news about how the liver can often repair.
Absolutely. So if you've got just early liver damage, for example, you can sometimes get fatty liver. Now, fatty liver is not only due to alcohol. It could be due to a poor diet, etc. But fatty liver can resolve once you remove the problem that's causing, whether it's a poor diet or excess alcohol consumption. At a lot of stages before you get to basically end stage liver failure, if you've reached end stage liver failure and cirrhosis, your liver is shrunken and shriveled and there is nothing you can do about it. But in the stages before that, if you curtail / stop the drinking, then the body has an amazing capacity to heal. So the inflammation can resolve, the liver can repair itself, and you can hopefully get back to better health. So it's the same with smoking. If you haven't caused irreparable lung damage, maybe you will not get back to the full lung function that you had, but your lung that's left will repair and replenish itself, and you will definitely have a better lung function if you stop smoking early on enough. So it's like with anything. If you overuse or abuse your body, but stop that abuse, then the body will repair and hopefully heal.
Yeah. Yeah, thank you. So, Dr. Sahel, do you just want to give us your website or where people can contact you if they are interested in private care, if they're in the area that you work?
Yes, so I cover Hertfordshire and Greater London, so areas like St Albans, Pinner, Harrow, Northwood, all those type of areas. So the website is www.drsahelhussain.com. And there's a landline number, 0203-633-6900. If you contact me through the website or call that number and leave a message, I will get back to you.
Great. We'll pop that in the show notes as well. I really appreciate your time, and the internet just about held out for us. So thank you so much for taking the time. And I really appreciate it. Thank you.
Thank you for asking me. I appreciate it. Thank you so much.
So thank you so much for sharing your information, Dr. Suhail. You can find more information about the work that he does at drsuhailhussain.com. And if you are interested in booking a consultation or whatever, you can find him through that site, and check out some of the private GPs in your area. I mean, wouldn't it be great if, you know, the NHS generally could just make a massive change here? It really would be incredible, wouldn't it, if we could have a situation where the NHS know where to point people, because not everyone is needing or wanting to go the Alcoholic Anonymous route, to go to AA. There are many people who don't identify as alcoholics. They are the term that, you know, I talk about all the time. They're grey area drinkers. They're somewhere on that spectrum. They're not at rock bottom. They don't want to identify as an alcoholic. They want to quit the booze and get free from the alcohol trap, and they can absolutely do that. And that's where, organisations like Alcohol Change UK can really help, offering some advice and some tips. And of course, programmes like the one that I offer in the Sober Club. So if this is an area of is of interest to you, please do check out thesoberclub.com. We have a membership community. It includes a course, Get the Buzz Without the Booze. So please check that out if it's something that's of interest. So thank you again, Suhail, and I'll see you for the next show.
You've been listening to the Natural Health and Sobriety Show on UK Health Radio.